Murray, we're here at Canoga, Hendersonville, and we've been having just a marvelous time. Bob Hayden and the Hayden Institute have put on a week-long conference, and we've got a couple analysts here, Jerry Wright and David Sparks, as well as many others who have been leading just wonderful, you know, conferences. The main theme is Christian, you know, dream work, so looking at dream work through a Christian lens, but a very open, tolerant lens as well. We're in the beautiful mountains of North Carolina. We're getting pummeled by rain, but that's okay. And we have gone about two-thirds through the DVD on the Red Book, the first one we did back in January that you and I produced. And we're going to, I understand, have an hour with you right now live. We'll have about an hour break, but we'll finish up the DVD, then come back with you, you know, live as well. And we are looking forward to hearing from you. Anything you want to say, Murray, before we dive into some questions from our crowd?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you and to see you. I have been at Canoga in the past. I was there with Journey into Wholeness. This was back in the 80s and 90s, and had the great pleasure of working with Robert Johnson and Marion Woodman and many other people during those years. So I can imagine very well what it's like for you there, what it's like to be there. It's a wonderful place.
Yes, that's right. I'd forgotten you had been there. Yeah. Well, welcome. Well, I've got a number of cards here I'm going to read. And as I mentioned before, as people hear your card being read, if you want to come up and engage Murray, feel free to do so. If you're highly introverted and want me to ham it up for you, that's fine as well.
Okay, right. I was just saying that when I first read through that passage in the Red Book, I was rather horrified by it, and I thought it was, well, I was really arrested by the image. It's a very, very powerful, difficult moment in Jung's passage through the underworld. And I was reviewing that just today, and I think it's very important to see where that moment comes. It comes after his incantations and his bringing Izdubar back to life. You remember Izdubar is the god from the east who is wounded by Western skepticism and philosophy and a-religious attitudes, atheism, God is dead, and so on. And Jung puts him in the egg, takes him home, and does these incantations over him. Again, very moving passages where he's breathing life back into this ancient god of the Middle East, of the Far East. And then Izdubar ascends. He goes up into the heavens, he becomes the sun, and Jung is left alone. And this feeling of a tremendous separation between the distant God up there in the heavens, transcendent, beyond, and the human down on earth has really caused a rupture in his feeling of relationship to the myth, to the divine, to transcendence. And it's in this period of rupture and loss and isolation that he makes this descent even further, and that's when he goes down into this hellish place where he discovers the girl with the fishhook through the eye of the worst devil to protect herself and to hold him off, to fend him off. And then comes this passage where he's instructed by the soul to eat the liver of this dead girl. And when he does it, your questioner, Rose, put her finger right exactly on the point. It is like a Eucharist in that one is, that he is taking into himself, digesting, making, you could say, integrating into his own soul, a piece of the divine, of the divinity. And this gives him the feeling of a God or the divine, or you could say eternity, being located within, not so far away. not at such a great distance. And so it is, it's precisely what in the Christian rituals, the traditional Catholic rituals, when you eat the body and drink the blood of Christ, you are taking the God into yourself, so that transcendence isn't so far removed. It brings the divine and the human into close contact. And Jung's feeling after he did that horrible thing and ate that piece of liver, nearly gagging as he did it, was that his connection to God within had been established and restored. So it's a very important moment of, you could say, coming closer or integrating the divine and the human, bringing these two polarities together. Because in previous religion and most religions, the gods are very distant. They live very far away. They live in the other world, or they're transcendent, or they're beyond. In the Christian religion, to which Jung really belongs, and much more deeply so than I ever realized before reading the Red Book, how Christian he really is in his deepest parts. In the Christian religion, these realms come together in the incarnation first, where time and eternity come together in the person of Jesus, and then in the rituals of the church later in the Eucharist, where the body and blood are taken into the individual human's soul and body, and so there is a deep inner relationship set up between the divine and the human. Yes.
I had a sense, though, in which he had to experience that sense of utter alienation and separation from the divine before he was ready to receive the God within, and it's something I was reading in Edinger, and I'd just like you to speak to that in the ego and archetype.
Yes.
Is that right on? I mean, I'm not a scholar. I'm trying to figure this stuff out.
Yes, well, I think Edinger's a good guide. There are a number of these moments in the Red Book. This is one of them where, you could say, Jung goes through a kind of initiation procedure or process where he becomes very closely related to, even identified with momentarily, a figure like Christ, or he comes very close to Izdubar. He comes very close to the transcendent, you could say, a number of times. And there is a kind of cycling between these moments of connection and communion and rupture, separation, alienation. There's a kind of cyclic process that he goes through. And I would say by the end of the Red Book, he's integrated it pretty well in the mandalas and the pictures that he creates of the cosmos, his cosmographic summaries in the mandalas, that he integrates this quite well. But one thing about the Red Book is we have to realize it's not the end of Jung's life. He still has a second half of life ahead of him. And I think he did a lot more work on that uniting, the union of the opposites. Mysterium Conjunctionis, his last great work, is about uniting these two realms as well. So it was an ongoing work. And I think this was, in the Red Book, we get a very deep, but could also say perhaps early, version of his powerful integration process as that gets kicked off in the second half of life.
Thank you. There's lots of questions coming in. Let's do this one next. What form did his active imagination take in the Red Book? What specifically was he doing? Was he meditating? Was he free-flowing imagery coming? Were any of these dreams?
He was doing a lot of things. The Red Book, as I explain in the seminars that you're looking at there, is a very complex, multi-layered work that is created over a period of about 16 years. So there are different levels. And You could say the first level, which we don't have access to, is the level of experience, where Jung is actually having these experiences in his active imagination during this period of time, very powerfully in the early part from 1913, 1914 to 1916, writes them down in what's called the black books, and then from that he makes a draft, a selection of entries from the black books. He doesn't add a lot, but he leaves about 50 to 60% out, is omitted from the final draft. So there's material in the black books that we don't have access to. That would be closer, we could say, to the original experience than what we have in the red book. And then to this draft, he adds reflections and commentaries. So what is he doing? He is having the experiences, kind of visionary experiences. There are a few, very few dreams represented in the red book. So woven into the material, there is some dream material. Then there's the active imagination that's recorded in the black books. And then there is the commentary that he adds and the reflections that he puts into the material. And then there are the paintings, which come still later. And so we have all these several levels. I think what Jung did in creating the Red Book was really a huge creative and reflective undertaking, in which he details and records and amplifies his midlife experience, his midlife transformation process. And he discovers parts of himself, and he recovers parts of himself that he had lost in the previous, 10, 15 years of his professional life. One of the things that he recovers powerfully is his artistic side, you could say, his work as an artist. Throughout his life, Jung created art, if you will. That is, he was quite a gifted painter already before the Red Book, but he painted scenery, he painted landscapes, he painted pictures. He wasn't painting inner images so much. Then with the Red Book, he starts painting these wonderful pictures that we have in here, and the calligraphy, and it's a work of art in a sense. You know, he's not creating it as art, but it's very artful. The way the medieval books of hours are artful, monks sitting there and scribing prayers and so on, and creating these beautiful pictures inside the frame of the prayer book that we treasure today and go for great sums of money at auction houses. And so it is a kind of art. He discovers an artful side of himself in this period. There, a tremendous amount of energy is released that finds its expression later in architecture. He built Bollingen in the 1920s. While he's still working on the Red Book, he starts stone carving. He does whittling and wood carving. So a whole side of himself that had gotten left behind, you could say, while he was busy with psychiatry and with Freud and all of that, and business, traveling, is recovered during this period and powerfully expressed, among other places, in the Red Book. So what is he doing there? He's really expressing himself. He's expressing his inner life. He's expressing talents and gifts that he has, also reflection and analysis. He doesn't use any technical language, any technical psychoanalytic or psychological language in the Red Book. It's very human. It's very direct account of his experiences and his reflections on them, his dialogues with these figures. So it's a great complexity. He's doing a lot of things in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Okay, next question, if we could. It's a art-oriented one as well. Given that Jung himself says it is not understanding of dreams that provides transformation, it is the intensity of the confrontation with the images, all in quotes, why is it that so little attention is being paid to the paintings They're obviously symbolic detail. Anyone who draws and paints knows it must have taken him more time to produce these images than to inscribe the text. Any comments on that?
Okay. Well, I think it's taking a while for people to get their arms around the Red Book, and I know people who are concentrating their attention on the paintings. In a way, the paintings and the pictures are almost a separate process. They come later than the active imaginations, and you could say the primary content. They come, and the pictures are there partially to illustrate the text, but partially they have a life of their own, and they develop in a separate and perhaps later stage of his midlife process. The mandalas, the mandala paintings start around 1916, 1917. A lot of these paintings take place in the 1920s. And I think in time, people will pay a great deal of attention to the pictures, not just as illustrations of the text, but as a kind of level or thread, almost separable from the text, as an expression of a further individuation thematic. Now, why did Jung create the Red Book, and why did he paint these pictures, and why did he put all this time into the calligraphy? It's a huge effort. And the best answer I can give to that is not just that he had time on his hands and he didn't know what else to do with himself. He was doing a lot of other things. Of course, during the years of the First World War, there was more time to engage in this kind of activity than normally, because Switzerland was cut off from the rest of the world. But he served in the army, and he was busy with his practice and his family. But why did he do it? There's a passage in Scrutinies, I believe, as I recall, if I've got that right, but I know it's in there somewhere, where the soul says to him, I want you to make concrete the thoughts that I give you. I want you to make them concrete. I want you to put them in some form, because by doing that, they gain more power. That's the way she puts it. That's the way the soul puts it. They gain these thoughts that I'm sending you, she says, will gain more power if you put them into a concrete form. Concrete form being painting, drawing, sculpting, calligraphy, all of that. Making the Red Book. Building Bollingen. Bollingen, he calls a testimony also to his individuation, his tower at Bollingen. So the idea is that if you take your inner life, which appears to you as dreams, images, themes, a lot of them pictures that come to you or images in your active imagination, and you don't concretize them in some way. You don't draw them, you don't paint, you don't do anything further with them. You maybe write them down in a book and close the book. You'll tend to forget it. It will fade rather quickly, the way a dream fades in the morning if you don't write it down, if you don't pay much attention to it. The more attention you give it, and the more you bring it into an incarnated form with material, in a material form, the stronger impression it will make on your memory, on your short and long-term memory. It will stay with you longer, and it will gain in its importance for your later life. So that's what Jung is really doing. He's building himself a foundation to stand on. You have to remember, he's just broken with Freud. He's disoriented. He doesn't know exactly what his way will be. He knows it isn't going to be psychoanalysis. He knows it isn't going to be further word association experiments that he did at the Birkholzli. He resigns from his position in the psychiatry department at the university.
So he's on his own, and what he's doing here is building himself a foundation for his later work and a standpoint that he can put his feet down on and rest on as he goes forward in life as a teacher, as an analyst, as a theoretician. So it's got to be solid. And in these paintings and in this Red Book, he's solidifying it. and he's giving it more substance. I was out at Bullingen one time with Jung's grandson, Ulrich Herney, who is responsible for the Red Book being published, incidentally. And he's now in the United States in Los Angeles, actually, at the Red Book exhibition there. I was out at Bullingen with him, and he put his hands on the stone walls. And he, like Jung, is rather big and has big hands, and he rubbed his hands on the walls. And he said, you know, when I came out here and I visited my grandfather, he would put his hands on the walls like this. He liked to touch things. He liked physicality. There was a sensate side to it that he found absolutely necessary to ground himself in life. And so building things, making things, he would sometimes sit and carve pieces of wood and make a little wood carving, hand it to his conversation partner as they left. These things are scattered all around the world, and families trying to collect them. And little works of art, but he was always busy with his hand. And it was to give form and substance, incarnate ideas into a material form. And in a sense, you could say this is very related to the Christian idea that you incarnate the spirit. The spirit wants to be incarnated, brought into the material world and given a form. And not to be worshipped, but to be recognized and to be brought into a position where consciousness will take more note of it. Okay?
Thank you. Next question is, what's important about the divine being imaged as a young, abused, you know, female? And also, any thoughts on the source of the liver, i.e. detoxification or something of that? I was referring back to that earlier image of Jung eating the girl's liver.
Well, you know, probably Jung's single most important dream, as he records it in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, in my way of thinking at least, there are many dreams in there, but the one that he gives signal importance to and says this is the culmination of the whole process is what he calls the Liverpool dream. And in that dream, he's actually in the city of Liverpool, and it's a dark night, and he's walking through the streets, and it's rainy, and then he comes upon this square that is a circle, and several streets converge on this place, and in the center of the square, there's an island, there's a water fountain, there's an island, there's a tree on the island, and the tree is emitting light. It's all lighted up, and the light comes from out of the tree. And he says this was the culmination of his search for a symbol of the self. 1928, a kind of abstract version of that picture is in the Red Book toward the one of, I think maybe the last picture, the last big picture in the Red Book is a reference to that dream from 1928. And then he comments on liver, and he says liver is the source of life. Liver is where, you know, we have our the seat of our life. And so he does something with the symbol of the liver. For him, it signifies life itself and the source of life, a kind of point of origin and location of psychic energy and libido and the center of the self in its incarnated form, in the liver. So he takes the symbol of the liver as being absolutely central for life. And I have a feeling that's a reference back to this scene, this act of imagination scene, in that hellish place where he's instructed by the soul to eat a piece of the child's liver. And why the child? Well, the child is a very important symbol in the Red Book, comes up several places, comes up very early. When he discovers the soul, he says it's a little girl, it's a child. That's a reference back to a dream he had in 1912 before the Red Book was begun, but probably sets this whole thing off, where he dreams of a young girl who comes first in the form of a bird, then turns into a young girl. He questions her, where do you come from? She says, well, I spend most of my time in the land of the dead. I'm released only for a few hours of the day. And he identifies her as a soul figure, an anima figure. So for Jung, the soul, the experience of the soul, is very much related to a young feminine figure or a somewhat androgynous child figure, which one gets later in the Red Book in the Phanes figure. Phanes, P-H-A-N-E-S, the young boy who combines a kind of more or less androgynous, combines the genders, combines the opposites, and is a puer, puella, eternus figure, who is also a symbol of the divine child. Jung wrote a very important essay on the symbol of the child, and it's very much related to the divine, the experience of the divine child, which is the kickoff point of the Christian story. God first appears in the form of a child. So this is very deeply embedded in Jung's personal mythology, that the soul appears as a child and one has to somehow partake of that. One has to integrate that, take that into oneself. And the very soul, heart and soul of the child, you could say, is in its liver. That's the innermost source of the energy in the divine child. And so that's where his active imagination leads him, to actually ingest that, take it into himself, as disgusting as he finds that whole business in that passage, but nevertheless feels great benefit from having done it, because it's it brings it closer to him and into the center of his life. Okay?
Yeah, thank you. Jeremy Taylor has a question. Jeremy's one of our presenters here, bringing for this weekend, and I invited him up to ask this question direct.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned earlier that it was difficult to put the Red Book into a coherent literary tradition other than the tradition that is embodied in Timeless Documents of the Soul. It seems to me there is a tradition, but it is a distinctly non-Christian tradition. It's the tradition of keeping a book of shadows, a liturgical journal of pagan and Wiccan enterprises. And I suspect it's one of the reasons why eating the liver of the child is so repugnant, that it comes from a different strain than this deeply ingrained strain of Christianity.
Well, it's certainly the case that Jung was very attracted to religious, say shadow religions around the mainline Christian tradition. So his studies of Gnosticism, alchemy, all of that. And what he found there, as opposed to when you study the texts within the main tradition itself, what he found was what he thought was something closer to experience, closer to dreams, closer to active imagination. So he thought that the Gnostics really were a kind of ancient form of psychologists in the modern sense. That is, people who explore the unconscious, who stick closer to experience than to conceptualizations, theologies, beliefs. Now, whether he, in that image of eating the child's liver, was borrowing from something that he had read or learned about Wicca or witchcraft or any of these marginalized and esoteric traditions, I really don't know. I guess the Red Book, which he calls the new book or the Liber Novus, but functioned for him as a kind of sacred text beside other sacred texts, if you will, a shadow book. He didn't show it to many people in his lifetime. So it was a kind of shadow text in analytical psychology until recently, actually. And a lot of people speculated on what was in there and why it wasn't shown more widely. Were there things in there that the analytical psychology tradition as it has formed and grown and developed worldwide would be shocked by, ashamed of, scandalized by? Well, maybe they will be. Some people will be. I personally don't find it all that shocking, but it's got material in it that you don't find in Jung's other writings. So it's a kind of shadow work, if you will, for the collected works. In some ways, the ground of the collected works, many of the writings in the collected works, the foundation or the source of a lot of the ideas and perspectives that you find, but in a very different kind of writing, much more, say, scholarly, abstract, intellectualized, to fit it into the modern vocabulary of depth psychology and so on and so forth. That's what Jung took to be his mission in the second half of life, to present what he had discovered in his own personal experience in a form, he said, that would also correspond to the spirit of the times. The Red Book is written from another perspective, the spirit of the depths, where he leaves the spirits of the times, goes into the depths, has these experiences, discoveries, and reflects on them. And then out of that, builds a, you could say, a philosophical and psychological series of perspectives that we call Jungian theory that has important continuities with that. Also goes further in some respects than what is in the Red Book. But there are many links back to it. So I like that comment about a shadow text. It is shadowy, has been kept in the shadows, now is publicized. There are, I know personally, several Jungians who wish it hadn't been. I'd rather keep it in the bank vault in Zurich.
Thank you. We've got quite a few more questions. I've always wanted to be Phil Donahue, though, so I'm going to walk down and ask anybody on this side of the room have a burning question that they'd like to ask. Do you want to ask verbally? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not doing reading. I'm doing Phil Donahue. I'll get to reading questions in a moment. Anybody have a burning question they'd really like to ask him directly? Come on, somebody's got a... Okay, here you go.
Good morning, even though it's 6 hours later for you. Is there any possibility, or have you heard anything about maybe eventually the 60% that was excluded from the black books being published or coming out so that we could study that also?
I asked Ulrich Herne that question when I read in the footnotes. One of the great treasures of this book are the footnotes that Sonu Shamdasani has created, some 1,000 footnotes. And if you look in those footnotes, and I think I've read all of them by now, you find quite a bit of additional material to what is in the Red, because he had access to the black books as he worked on this text for 10 years. And in some of the footnotes, he will show changes that Jung made when he transferred the material from the black to the Red Book. And he will occasionally add sentences or passages that are not in the Red Book, but that can be found in the black books to amplify what is in the Red Book. But by far, the vast majority of that material is not published. And so I asked Ulrich Herne if there was any plan to edit and publish the black books. And he told me it's under discussion. What that means is maybe within our lifetime, because publication of the Red Book was under discussion for quite a long time before a decision was actually made to go ahead with it. But I'm hoping that over time that Sonu Shamdasani and the Philemon Foundation will receive permission to edit those black books, because, of course, it won't be as beautiful as this. It isn't as finished. But there would be, at least for historians and for people who are interested in where some of Jung's ideas come from, a lot more material than we have. So, yeah, but what he says in the footnotes and in his introduction, I think, is that about 40 to 50% of the black books is now published in this Red Book.
Thank you. Is there another question? Ask a live question.
Yes, there seems to be a considerable amount of energy surrounding this episode of the consumption of the liver. And of course, Jung was profoundly interested in theology, and he'd already published volume 5 of Symbols of Transformation. I'm wondering if there's any relationship, or if you see any relationship here between the Red Book liver and the consumption of the liver by the eagle in the case of Prometheus, who is chained to the Caucasus Mountains.
I need to add one thing to that. Steve is a pathologist, which might have some bearing to that. He's looked at a lot of livers in his time.
Well, you catch me a bit off guard because I haven't made that connection to the passage in Volume 5. I'd have to take a look at that. Just off the top of my head, it seems quite different because Prometheus is being punished by Zeus for stealing from the gods and giving technology and fire and so on to human beings. Prometheus breached the divide between the gods and the humans. Of course, that would be a link here because by eating the liver, Jung is closing the gap between the divine and the human and ingesting the divine, and so he has an experience of the God within. I suppose on some level one could make those kinds of comparisons, but I can't do much more with that question. It's very interesting, and I will take a look. Maybe in our break I'll try to look up Prometheus in Volume 5. I've got it right here in my library and see if we can come back to that one.
Wow, what service. This is so amazing to have you here, Murray. We're really enjoying the various technology pieces. Thank you. But we're not done yet. We have another 10 or 15 minutes for this part. There have been a number of questions, Murray, about the actual way in which Jung did the act of imaginations. I know you've spoken a little bit about that, but could you give us a little more information of, as he was preparing, I guess, the black books, in essence, what techniques did he use to engage into the act of imaginations? Any ideas on that?
Okay. He talks about that. Probably the best introduction to the Red Book and what's going on in there generally is, I think it's chapter 6 of Memories, Dreams, Reflections, Confrontation with the Unconscious. And there he gives a view from a distance, from the distance of old age. He's telling about, or whenever he created that chapter, but it's in retrospect. He's looking back on this period, and he gives you quite a bit of information about what was going on at that time and how he went about doing this. Whether it's altogether accurate or not, I can't say. I know there are some discrepancies between what we find in the Red Book now and what he says in that chapter in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. For instance, he says that in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, it was a bright summer's day when he and his family were sitting in the house and they heard the doorbell ring, and nobody was there. And the house was filled with spirits. And then they began to speak. We have come back from Jerusalem. We are not satisfied. And there came forward in the next few days the 7 sermons to the dead. Actually, that took place in January and February of 1916, not in the summer, according to the Red Book account, at least. And I would tend to trust the Red Book over Jung's memory. So there are small discrepancies. Anyway, that's a detail. What did he do? How did he stimulate this? I think partly he didn't have to do very much to stimulate his active imaginations. I think he was caught up in them. I think, as he describes it, there was a lot of pressure from the other side, if you will, from his imagination, from his unconscious, to release some of these thoughts and images. That's one thing that he says in that chapter. There was pressure. It wanted to come out, so all he had to do is basically open the valve, and out it flowed. To some extent, that seems to be the case. As I started reading in the first book of the Red Book, the Liber Primus, it looked to me like he had to work harder than that, though, because he doesn't get into it right away. In the first few nights, he makes contact a bit with a soul figure, but it takes some days, maybe a month or so, before he really penetrates into the cave. and there's an opening into a greater depth. And so he goes in and out of this depth. Sometimes he pops out of it for a little while, then he goes back into it. Figures come, figures go. He says in Memories, Dreams, Reflections that one way he found useful for him to release his fantasies, as he puts it, to release his fantasies, was to play. And during the noon hours, typically he'd take off a couple hours for lunch. It was a traditional thing. You'd eat at home, the cook or the wife would prepare a nice meal for you. And after his lunch, instead of taking a nap, he went out into the garden and he started playing like a child, he said, building little fortresses, little roads, sort of playing with figures, building things. And he said it was like returning to his childhood games, which you can read about in earlier chapters in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And he says, as he did this, and probably people thought he was a bit strange for doing it, his children maybe, I don't think were included in the games. They weren't really a part of this. He said that as he played these games, the images would be released. His fantasies would be released. So I think he did some things to trigger and get them to become active. Sometimes I think he did it deliberately, and sometimes I think they just came upon him. There's another passage in the Red Book where there's a long absence for about a year from the summer of 1914 to the summer of 1915, I think, more or less, yeah. After the First World War breaks out on August 1st, 1914, there's a silence. And then he says he's out on the lake in his boat, and he loved to sail, so he was puttering around out on the lake. And he saw a kingfisher bird dive down into the water and pull up a big fish out of the water. And then he heard a voice, and he said he recognized the voice as the voice of his soul or Philemon. I can't remember which one it was. The voice said, "What is below will be revealed." And that set off the whole new series of material that we have in Scrutinies. A large part of Scrutinies comes after that event, the Seven Sermons to the Dead and the later portions of Scrutinies follow from that moment on the lake. So there are like these announcements. It doesn't come immediately. A few months pass, and then in the fall it begins. So I think as it was very active, he probably didn't sleep that well. He got up in the middle of the night. My impression is that a lot of this happened at night. At least that's what he says. He says during the day there's a day world, and he's working in his practice and doing other things. He's also giving lectures there during this time. He's quite active. He founds the psychological club with his wife Emma during the period. There are lots of people around him. He's not isolated. He's not off by himself somewhere in the mountains. He's in his home. But at night, while these fantasies are very activated, I think he's up. He's writing them down. He's having the experiences. He's recording them. And then later, and for years later, he's meditating on them. He's thinking about them. He's writing commentaries. He's putting them into the Red Book and calligraphy. He's painting the pictures. So the material comes, gushes out. He gets a hold of it, and then he works on it. That seems to be the rhythm. And I don't think he ever had another period in his life that was like this. To my knowledge, there weren't, you know, this didn't continue after 1916, I think, is the end of it. The rest of it is putting it into a form. He did have other, of course, big dreams, important experiences, insights, I'm sure more active imagination, dialogues with Philemon in later years, but it was nothing like this. This is like the birth of a new star or something, or the beginning of something immense. And it was only one time in his life. And at the end of Memories, Dreams, Reflections, this is the source of everything else that was to come, came out of this period.
Well, thank you. We've got about 4 minutes left. I'm going to ask one last question. It's sort of another morbid question. I think we have a morbid audience here today. And you may not have any comment on this. It's sort of a more historical question. Do you know anything about the psychiatrist to whom Adolf Hitler went with his horrible, disturbing dreams. As I understand it, Hitler had a psychiatrist executed and confiscated and destroyed all his records. And do you have any awareness of that? That's an intriguing question.
No, I have no awareness of a psychiatrist to Hitler. The only thing I can relate to that is that at one point, apparently, somebody in Hitler's close circle wanted to have a consult with Jung about Hitler's sort of madness. And they were worried, this was in the 1930s sometime, that Hitler was either drinking too much or he was losing his mind in some way. And they tried to arrange an appointment with Jung. And I think the story is that Jung actually went to Berlin, was in a waiting room. Hitler was supposed to show up for an interview, and of course didn't show up, canceled the interview, and Jung went home. I think Jung was there with C.A. Meyer at the time. This was in the 1930s sometime. To my knowledge, Jung never met Hitler. Hitler did come to Zurich in the 1920s a couple of times to raise funds. I was in a place the other day in a hall near a museum, and it was a meeting, and the man who was conducting the meeting said, well, in 1923, Hitler was sitting in this room, and he was trying to raise funds from the Zurich bankers. To our knowledge, he wasn't successful, thank goodness. But I don't know that Hitler had a psychiatrist. If you can find information about that, I'd be very interested to hear about it. I think you badly needed help. Whether he ever got it. Steve.
I will not take that one on. I don't want to be executed by a world tyrant. So it's at our time. It's 10:30. My